So, hi everyone. Hi Bart. Hi Christine. So, it is the last talk of the season in Paris before we enter our summer season. So since Monday, I was kind of sitting with the question, what can I talk about for this last Dharma talk? And the question that came to me was, what did I learn this year? How was my practice this season, and what did I learn? So a couple of things that came up for me. Once that w was that, and also it's the almost finishing my second year after transmission. So it's always very different. The first year was very different. The second year is very different from the first. So on the side of doing all these all the retreats and the So I've been teaching in very secular contexts, university and in international institution. And so I think one of the things I've explored is how to speak about the practice without using any Zen terminology. That was one of the things I learned. I explored a lot. And one of the things I was thinking, maybe that could be interesting for you is one of the things that helped me a lot was something that I learned last year from Stephen Batchelor. That I feel it's very kind of four key concepts that draws a framework, a very clear framework with what we do. And I've been using that a lot in trying to explain what we're doing. And so for those of you who is not familiar with Stephen Batchelor over the years have been trying to develop kind of a secular approach to the Dharma. And by doing that, trying to map what the kind of the path, what the path looks like. And so he developed kind of four task model with the acronym ELSA. And what through discussions that I was having with him and that we were having together during a program that I was doing last year, something actually emerged from it. So this ELSA framework is the first task is to E for embrace, to embrace life. This is really what we do with meditation. We really embrace whatever our experience is. And this is really one of the core dimension of the what the mindfulness training is all about, embracing. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of mental states, mindfulness of thoughts, really embracing what is happening for us. And what came out of that is that what we're doing, that the type of mindfulness, how we could qualify that mindfulness, is existential. It's existential mindfulness. We are mindful of our existence. So that's the first task, linked to the task of embracing our life. That is the existential mindfulness dimension of what we're doing. The second task is kind of echoing the second noble truth, is to let reactivity be. And letting reactivity be means, as we have all experienced in meditation, things arises and we allow these things to arise, and we don't intervene, we don't follow up on our thoughts. And so that could be called therapeutic mindfulness, because it's very therapeutic. This is a major turn when we manage to do that, to let reactivity be. That is really transformative for our own life. The third task, which is S, the S of Elsa, seeing the ceasing of reactivity. So we basically dwell in there. We basically dwell in that space of non-reactivity. And that could be called contemplative mindfulness. And the fourth dimension, which echoes the fourth noble truth about the middle way, is really activate, act. Or as Bernie used to say, loving action, or just action. And that could be called ethical mindfulness, because that is very much, it's the Eightfold Path, the middle way, the Eightfold Path, the precepts. So everything that has to do with the way we relate in the world. So existential mindfulness, therapeutic mindfulness, contemplative mindfulness, and ethical mindfulness, the four dimensions of mindfulness. For me, that framework has been extremely useful to present this path in a very secular context. And I've been really kind of really trying to link all these various aspects to our practice, our very kind of formal Zen practice, and trying to see how it overlaps, and always with these kind of steps or frameworks, it always looks like a very kind of linear program, and very kind of distinctive dimension, where obviously when we do something, we do it all at once. At least the three first tasks. When we sit, we really put into practice the three first tasks. Then when we get up from the cushion and we go to the kitchen to help, then we enter the realm of ethical mindfulness most of the time, because it's relational. So that's, for me, that was that This year was really a year where I was really exploring this. And then today, as I was continuing asking myself that question, where did I learn? A koan came back, as often. A koan comes back when I think of a particular question. A koan comes back that fit that is really kind of right on the theme. And the koan that came to mind is the one about gutai. So gutai had a teacher, Tenryu, that was in China in the 9th century. And the teachings of Gutai was just raising his finger. That was his teaching, raising his finger. Questions, he was just raising his finger. And so the koan itself is just Gutai raising the finger, basically. However, there is a secondary story in this koan. Well, first of all, we could stop with that, and it's like, what does that mean? Like, the whole teaching is basically, what does he mean by just raising a finger? It's a real temptation. I know that Roshi has that, and Gena Roshi has that, you know, that thing of, God, what on earth can we say about the Dharma, you know, when we give a Dharma talk, you know, just it's all contained. There's nothing much to say, and just we could just stay in silence, and that would be it. And that would fulfill the, or this koan, like the guy who, the teacher that goes on the roast room and then leave the roast room, because that's it. What else? So pointing, right, pointing. I think we have a sense of that sort of beyond words. So what else is there to do, to say and to do? But I find the secondary story even more interesting. I mean, that was the part that I was re that I've that I was relate I could relate to, is that a visitor came to visit Gutai, and he bumped into one of his monks, and he said, "What does your teacher preach? What does he teach you?" And so the monk raised his finger. And when Gutai heard about that, he just took the monk's finger and just like broke it. He's repeating. He's really repeating what his teacher just, how his teacher manifested his teaching, the teaching, his teaching. And for me, that was a that it's a big question. How do I manifest the teaching? How do I express myself? How do I just embody what I understand, what I understood, instead of repeating words from Stephen, from Roshi, from whoever? And so Debbie and Christine were in part of the retreat we did last week. And for me, that was very interesting. I kind of changed a few things that I felt for me was made sense. And was probably more formal than Roshi is. We did ceremonies, which usually we don't do that, we don't do that much. We did probably more chantings than we do usually. Just, a few details. And it's, of course, it's very scary because I don't want to be unfaithful to the teaching. And yet, I would be unfaithful to the teachings I've received if I were not trying to find my own expression. And of course, we never know, I never know how it's going to be received, if it's exactly what I should be doing in terms of consequences. But I can only take the risk, and that's my duty to take the risk. The risk of my own voice. The risk of finding and expressing my own voice. And of course, I say my, but it's not my in the usual sense. And I get really all growing into that ability to find our own voice. I was mentioning during the retreat that we're looking at the precepts, and I was mentioning how four of the 10 precepts have to do with the voice or the way we speak or the way we hear. And really, I think we can take it even further and really hearing that voice thing in terms of this authentic voice, authentic path, authentic being that I'm bringing to people. The way I listen and the way I speak is the way that is wholesome, that is conform is works in is conform is adequate to the precepts is a way to embody this ethical Buddhist path. So we are so I hope you can reflect on how you grow and have a sense of that it's at the same time brings you closer to who you are and expressing your own voice, and at the same time, it becomes less and less you in the sense of being fixed to an opinion or an idea about who we are. There's a freedom that operates. And maybe another realization, insight for me, or it's not new, but I'm deepening that. I am so I'm always more aware how the Sangha is the community work, the is so essential to our practice. And when it's not present, when people do the work on their own, it makes it's there's always a feeling of well, it's a lack of support, or also a difficulty to be challenged in where we get stuck, or by the simple fact that we do that on our own. And I appreciate so much, and I'm so appreciate so much the Sangha and the relationships and the work that is that is being done, that we do by the fact that we do that together. And I it's just the value is immense. I'm so grateful. And I grow because you're there, because I can do retreats, and I grow with you in that. And it's marvelous. And this is something that I can recognize its value, because in all the secular work that I do, that doesn't really exist to that extent. And I can really see how it works as a support system. I mean, so many days during the year, I was tired. I didn't really want to sit, or and I just sat because I knew that it was there, and I knew it was important that I was there. If it hadn't been there, or if yeah. I wouldn't have sat, and that would have had consequences in what I cultivate, in the effort that I put in the cultivation of the qualities that are important to me and that are part of this path. And it works on many levels, many circles in a way. I have peers, I have teachers to whom I speak, I have people in the Dharma to whom I can talk to. And I feel it's such a richness. And I'm watching Bart. You can't notice that, Bart, because we're on screen, but I know in your position that also how it's important to be able to speak with all the, to go to all the sanghas, to talk to all the purple rakusus, and then to talk to, young teachers and old and more senior teachers. And I keep doing that, and I feel it's always such an inspiration, to be able to see how the others are doing and how the others are expressing their own voice each time, and how they manifest it. What's the form they use to convey this? What's their language? What are their tools? Their skillful means. I find it immensely rich. And so we are really putting ourselves at each other's disposal, at each other. We are all available for each other to work this path, walk this path together. For me, that keeps this keeps being very inspiring. And I keep learning a lot by sharing with teachers, non-teachers, senior students, whoever. Yeah, for the moment, I think that's all I have to say. And open up, and I would be happy to hear also what you've learned this year. One day I was in Oregon in the Great Vow Monastery, Shozen Roshi and Hogen Roshi, and we were so many, we were about 60 people, I think, and we did a council circle at the end, but because there were so many people and it would have taken forever if we would have done the usual thing, Hogan said, "Okay, each of you'll say one insight and one thing that you've learned." That's it, two things. One insight and one thing that you've learned. That was quite something. But it's they were good questions. That was a good question. What have we learned? What's our insight? So I leave the floor to you. All questions.
Merci. Hello, everybody. I hear you talking about the importance of the Sangha and I think it's last year for me it was very important that I assume little compromises in the Sangha. It's not so much. There are little, very little compromises, but for me, it does too much because I feel inside, even if I'm alone in my place, doing my things, I feel I'm doing something in the for the for the living from this sangha, even if it's very little. The Friday coming here every morning and opening the zendo to do the meditation, it's for me a very good teaching. It's something that it happens also in other moments in my life, but I think I take conscience from this importance because I'm here and I do these little things. Is open the zendo for, I take responsibility, I take a compromise.
You mean a commitment?
Yeah.
Not a compromise, a commitment.
A commitment, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
A commitment, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is a good example of how, you know, if we might be scared or we feel, oh my God, you know, who am I to do this, blah, blah, blah. You know, the Sangha is also gives us the possibility to step in and to do that. And to maybe to face our fear or face our difficulty to actually step in and take a commitment. So that again is a, yeah, the Sangha as a leverage. I find that's very, it's very important. That gives us opportunities, you know, to explore certain dimensions. And this is what we do in retreats also, when we take this function or that function, we take responsibility and we can plunge into that role, that function that has been given and that we took, that we accepted. Thank you, Sue.
Good evening, everyone. I was curious when you were talking about this, explaining the Dharma to secular people, because although it's a very important part of my life, this practice, I realize I don't speak much about it with my circle of friends or family, or maybe one or two more engaged with this kind of subject. Because in general, I feel that people have some prejudice with something that must be... appears to be related to with religion, rituals, wearing a robe, chanting, whatever. So I not on purpose, but I feel that I don't speak so much about something that it's very important in my balance and in my life. So my curiosity is, When you use, let's say, more scientific clothes to the Dharma, when you talk with secular people, you feel that people are more receptive when you don't use the more religious aspect of it. I don't know. I'm just curious.
Well, I first of all, I my experience is that this practice points to a human experience that is shared by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe before explaining anything, you know, what I love the most is just do a very simple meditation, guided meditation, and then a lot of questions arises from here. And we may feel, because we've practiced for a long time, that it's all obvious and all that, but for the people that start for the first time, that suddenly realize, oh my God, so many thoughts, and God, I failed totally to have an empty mind. And then we can say, why do you want to have an empty mind? You know, don't try to get an empty, you know, so that's, because that gets rid of some misconceptions about what meditation is, for example. Mm-hmm. So, and part of me feels also that I know that it can look like from the outside very religious what we're doing, but I'll also identify a lot of, kind of religion has also to do with dogma, and I feel I really have difficulties to see where our dogmas are, because, you know, this is our koan. You know, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. If you feel you have dogmas anywhere, just investigate that. And what's my experience? And when I'm hesitant, when I don't really, you know what to say, I always ask myself, what's my experience? Okay, I'm not going to say anything else that is not my experience. That's all I can share. And so where's that religious? You know, where? And yet I know, I can imagine why people might think that it's religious. So maybe mm-hmm. there's certain things that, but very often what I noticed, and that was a very interesting thing that happened last week at the retreat. There were four newcomers. And I'm always scared when there are newcomers that if I put too much form, it's gonna create an aversion, a feeling of aversion, because, oh my God, they're gonna think, oh my God, the bowing, and it's gonna be too religious, or all kinds of. And I realize that happens over and over and over again to me. That is just my opinion. It's never what happens, actually. It's always my problem. It's hardly ever their problem. Yet I also feel that if I introduce that correctly, I get rid of some of the misconceptions. They can, you know, some of the traps, like, you know, bowing, we're not bowing to a god, let's be clear, you know, just okay, so let's get rid of that.
Yeah. I once brought an American to your place. I don't know if you remember that. That was years ago in the beginning when I still lived in Paris. And in the end he said, oh, and this bowing crap. We didn't say anything. He just had a meditation practice at Vipassana or something, and I brought him once, and I think he also didn't do it. He just said, "Oh, this bowing crap."
Yeah, I mean, bowing can be a real hindrance for people, and
he had no idea about
right.
what it really is. So
right, and I feel probably as sometimes it's good to introduce that to people, or say you don't have to do it, you know, and just to have a sense of what it's all about, so that some people just easily do whatever is being offered, and some people are more resistant, and we need to respect that. And I think also we can help the people who are resistant by giving a couple of explanations. And sometimes this is what I try to do. And in some areas in where I teach, universities and all that, this is, you know, this certainly probably not appropriate. So I don't do it, you know, because that could be misinterpreted.
Mm-hmm. So in those contexts, you use the word mindfulness, or what, meditation?
Yeah, mindfulness. I mean, yeah, mindfulness is a word, awareness, attention. I mean, it depends what I want to convey. Yeah. I mean, the framework that I was mentioning, for me, that's That's a very useful framework to talk about our practice. The notion of compulsion, reactivity, addiction, to talk about reactive patterns, habitual patterns. This is like things of vocabulary that I use a lot. And I find it very, and now I'm trying to do, it's very new for me. I try to do the work in French also, because I'm not used to speak about the Dharma in French. I always speak English. So that's also an effort that I need to do, translation effort. And basically it always goes back to, how do I make it my own? And also, how do I speak a language that the person will be able to understand, depending on where I am and what is suited in this particular context? Mm-hmm. And I talk to finance people and try to see where they are. And it's ultimately, it's a human experience that we're talking about. It's the difficulty to live our life with everything that is going on, and so it's not a Buddhist thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, Debbie.
I just wanted to say, well, I want to say a whole bunch of things. But one thing in particular, when we were coming back on the train, Christine and I, we were sort of I started it. I was sort of showing us off. We looked really good in comparison with those people. A yoga teacher, she was like out after about the second hour, and we can sit for 6 hours and not faint. And we, in the end, we were like these champions, because it's hard work. I mean, sometimes you do a session and you think you're being grouchy or I'm being this, but it's hard work, really. You know, 6 hours of sitting, and that was so obvious during the weekend, because they were falling like flies and we were kind of still holding up under the pressure of the thing. It was fun. And I also wanted to really second this idea of, or this, the it's not an idea, the reality of Sangha, because I worked in a very difficult neighborhood, and I was in the same school for 15 years, and we spent Christmas together talking about the ideal school. We were into it, and I never thought I would meet this experience again. I realized after I retired that most people don't have that in their workplace, where you're really 10, 15 people on the same track, working in the same direction. It was very exhilarating. People didn't want to go home on Friday afternoon. But I have that feeling in this Sangha, and it's so important that we're, even despite all kinds of differences and the presence of different nationalities, I find really fascinating now that I know the Portuguese people were not from the same place, but we're on the same path. We're going in the same direction. We're willing to make the same efforts. The minute I say that, I think, I don't want to choose, but it's a very important aspect of this in case.
Yeah, thank you, Debbie. I too realized during this weekend that it's really hard and difficult practice. And sometimes, last time when I came back from the retreat, I talked to several people I know, and, oh, you should come one day, and I'm sure you will like that. And after this weekend, I thought, oh, maybe not. Not everybody will appreciate sitting down for all those hours a day. I mean,
It's a crazy thing. Sitting for 7 years, 7 hours. But I think some of us need that, this exigence too much to can appreciate, perhaps everybody, but I think that yeah, I don't know how to say. I remember the first session where Joa was sensei in Coimbra, and he talked about someone, a sculptor, someone who did a piece of wood, a work with a piece of wood, and for me it's there. I can't explain more, but it's this exigence with ourselves to try to not to be ourselves, or to be honest, to be sincere with what we do in the world. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's the image of the wood turner in the Pali Canon, I think that you're referring to, that the craft, it's the image of what we're doing as the craftsmanship of a wood turner that really works on wood and just goes endlessly just trying to work on this piece of wood. Yeah. And Christine, actually, I cannot remember anybody who left a retreat thinking, oh my God, this was horrible, never again, actually. Some people don't show up, but they don't seem to dislike it. And I think it has to do with, you know, I see people struggling, and I've struggled myself on many retreats. It's a little bit like having us on a boat when you have, I've had the worst seasickness being on a boat, and while being sick, I remember thinking, never again, I'll never go on a boat anymore. And then it disappears, and then you see a dolphin on the side of the boat, and then you completely forget about the thing, and then the next thing you know, you're on the boat again. It feels a little bit like that, a little bit. You know, the bad times, the good times outweigh the bad times, and ultimately we feel that we grow, and it has been beneficial for us. I mean, that was at least that's my experience, and I guess if we're still on the screen tonight, it's probably because it's the case for all of us.
Yeah. And yet the then in everyday life, when you observe people and see what they're doing, and I mean, sometimes it just despairs me, you know, when I see kids being mean to other kids, and or today there was a snail on the way and one just stepped over it and crushed it, and there were three around saying, hey, why did you do it? So that gives some hope, maybe. But
well, that personally, that gives me some faith in our practice, in the sense that this is why it's so essential a practice feel is absolutely, I mean, this is, yeah, it's so essential. And the question of how do I respond to the suffering of the world? And, you know, we had riots in France and rage, anger, people feel they're not being heard and people feeling that they're left behind and our society and their environmental crisis and so on and so forth. And I deeply feel that our practice tackles on all these subjects. That's my deepest conviction. It has to do with recognizing, listening, hearing, being able to find our own voice, understanding the interdependence and therefore understanding how the environment and all life forms are so important to our own well-being. I mean, all these practice addresses these issues, and this is one area where I feel, God, it's vast. How do we grow? I mean, what to do? How to act based on that practice? So it's really kind of the fourth task: action, loving action, and following the precepts and the realm of the realm of interbeings and interdependence and relativity and just the world, like acting. So trying not to be depressed about what's going on, but just like more trying to think, okay, that's the insight. So how can I help? How can I serve? How can I share so that there's less of that, even though it's just endless. And that's our vows, you know. Sentient beings are numberless, the suffering of human beings or living beings are endless, isn't it?
Thank you.
And I vow to just keep going, keep on serving.
Yeah, true. I mean, being aware is the first step to make a change. So,
yeah. Yeah, the getting rid of ignorance and delusion and greed so that we can just move on and act more appropriately. And not thinking that, oh my God, I'm just going to save everyone. That's it. And if I don't, why doing it? Why doing the small things that I can do? Well, because that's what I can do. Yeah.
Yes. It is a good question. What did I learn this year? I'm not sure. But I think what last year did for me was that I again found new ways to look at this practice. Because often I still am sitting with this question: why am I doing this? Why? So I have to find again and again a new way to explain this to myself, or to find out why. And yeah, this year somehow I really got in love with this practice again. Mm-hmm. You know, you know just for sure this is what I want. Don't know why exactly, but I'm inspired to. So I completely agree with what you said, and you all said about Sangha, because that's exactly what Sangha does. Get inspired and to be brought to that stream. And I think the next thing I learned is to understand how the Dharma sounds in French. That's maybe less important, but also nice.
Yeah, and we are very fortunate with to be part of the white, I feel, to be part of the White Plum lineage, because there's so many teachers all around the world, and they all embody the Dharma in very different ways, and so inspiring, really. And it's great to see all these manifestations, all these people, all these ways to do it. And I really love it.
Yeah, and not only the teachers, but also all those Sangha members, all the people who are in France, or I met in France or wherever, online, on screen. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and guided by the same thrive, the same energy, same direction. That brings me back to this sutra that I like so much about the old city that is being rediscovered, you know, by the Buddha. He's like giving the image of this path as leading to an ancient city. And he is not creating a path. He's walking on a path that a trail that has been, that was there, and a trail is a trail because people walk on it. If people stop walking on it, then it's the trail becomes ends up, disappears at the end. So we need to walk on it for the trail to continue to exist, and ultimately it leads to a city. It leads to we live together, to a place where we live together. However difficult that is, and it's difficult to live with people. we know that in sanghas and in families, and if we have neighbors, and if we live in a building with other people and with a copropriété, and it's, yeah. As Sartre used to say, you know, l'enfer c'est les autres, hell is the others. Yeah. But as I also add, it's also paradise. It can't be, Debbie. It's.
I didn't say a word.
But I was like.
We could hear you think.
Not my neighbors. All right, we'll stop here. Thank you. It's 9:30. Thank you. Thank you.
We should invite Bart someday to give a talk.
Yeah. Thank you.